You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we continue delving into the Bigfoot phenomena by looking at a state perhaps not as well known for encounters with hairy hominids, Maine. Despite being the home of Stephen King, and of course the legend that is Lauren Coleman and his wonderful International Cryptozoology Museum, Maine has kept most of its Bigfoot encounters close to its chest. Now at last, the Pine Tree State has finally begun to reveal some of its encounters, thanks to Michelle Soulier's brilliant new book, Bigfoot in Maine. Michelle is, of course, the talent behind both the Strange Maine blog and book, as well as running the incredible Green Hand Bookstore in Portland, Maine. Michelle joins me to discuss some of the cases covered in the book, the challenges she's faced to get the book completed, and unveil some of Maine's more unusual Bigfoot encounters. It was a pleasure delving into the history of Bigfoot in Maine with Michelle, and I'm sure you'll be intrigued by the witness accounts we cover. As always, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon for $4 a month for ad-free early access to every episode, bonus content, and more. The link, as always, is in the show notes. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can support the channel by subscribing to YouTube for Mysteries and Monsters, and the website is, of course, mysteriesandmonsters.com. Thanks as always to Dean Bestel for his artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let's join the marvellous Michelle Soulier to uncover Bigfoot in Maine. On this week's show, I am delighted to be joined by author, illustrator, and the owner of the Green Hand Bookshop, Michelle Soulier, a lover of all things weird and strange in the state of Maine and beyond. Michelle's new book, Bigfoot in Maine, is a fantastic addition to anybody's collection. Michelle, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
I'm delighted to be part of Mysteries and Monsters. Thank you.
Oh, you are very, very welcome. And I think it would only be fair to mention that a big thank you to Michelle D. For sending me a copy of your fantastic book all the way from America, which is one of those wonderful things about doing this show, is occasionally I get lovely gifts through the post. And it was quite fortunate because I'd seen the book pop up, because obviously doing this show, I'm often reading and keeping my eye on the internet and certain feeds and articles and things. And I'd seen your book pop up. And obviously I was aware of your Strange Maine blog for quite a while. So I have been aware of you. Not that I'm sort of stalking you, Michelle, but so you're someone I've been aware of. And I know you spoke at the 2018 Cryptozoological Conference as well.
Yes, I did. That was a little presentation I did, which kind of started to help me sum up what the book was going to be about. So it was a very helpful thing to do.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting that from that germination, because Bigfoot is something that, for anybody who's not as obsessed with the subject as perhaps we are, Michelle, would often raise an eyebrow when stories like this would appear sort of 20 years ago. But I think it's a subject that's developed so much over the last 10, 15 years that I think I'm surprised there aren't more books of a similar vein to yours that are focusing on these states that perhaps people are not aware of that does have such a history of Bigfoot.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we'll probably be seeing that change because I feel like we're kind of at a sea change in the public attitude to Bigfoot and cryptozoology. I feel like, you know, while a lot of people love to make fun of finding Bigfoot, I feel like it's been hugely influential in kind of normalizing that conversation to a certain extent. And I think it's also let people who had experiences like that know that they're definitely not alone.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've been shocked at the really genuinely good newspaper articles and interviews that have come out of my publishing the book. I definitely didn't expect people to be so receptive and so curious about it. I expected much more kind of backlash. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't been happening, knock on wood. I've actually gotten people who have read a bit of the book or read the whole book and gotten very curious and had real questions. And that's very different from what I expected based on, you know, prior decades of public attitude to this.
Yeah, I think it really helps because for me, I find one of the book's strongest points is that it's very matter of fact. There's no kind of wild speculation. It's simply a collection of very compelling witness encounters, as well as a historical introduction, as you said. And I was aware of a couple of those stories because I'm fortunate enough I own Chad Armitt's incredible The Historical Bigfoot, which has got one of those wonderful stories in Maine that's always intrigues me, and I'm always really compelled by it, is when they have these interviews or people you speak to, and you've got a couple in your book as well, Michelle, where they have a hunter who loves going out hunting. It's all he likes to do. And he has an encounter with something he can't explain. And I think the one in Chad's book is a gentleman called Samuel Spaulding, who in 1876 stumbled across some weird wood devil, or whatever he wanted to call it in those days, that terrified him so much that he was so distressed by what happened, he refused to leave his house. And I always love stories like that when you talk to hunters and people that go outdoors in the woods all the time, especially in North America, and something happens to them and it completely changes their world.
It really does. It turns it right on their head, or right on its head.
Yeah. And I suppose one of the biggest aspects, and as you mentioned there, when we were talking about how Bigfoot seems to be becoming more normalized, if such a subject could be, Michelle, is over the last sort of 10, 15 years with things like Monster Quest and Finding Bigfoot, Expedition Bigfoot, and a variety of shows, clearly there is a real appetite for this subject, and it's made it a lot easier for people to be honest a bit more about it. I would suspect that when you started this book, the biggest worry you had, being new to the topic as well, I suspect, is that people just wouldn't talk to you, didn't want to open up, because at the end of the day, they didn't know who you were.
Yeah. I'd been doing the Strange Maine blog for some time and, you know, had been associated with Lauren Coleman because he started the public presence of his International Cryptozoology Museum was in my bookshop when we first opened in 2009. Huh. But beyond that, you know, I'm not known as, you know, a field investigator or a cryptozoologist. I'm more on the historical end of things. And so shifting to doing oral history and talking to people who have had encounters and going out and actually visiting locations and trying to learn more about, you know, the outdoorsmanship that it takes to understand that environment was, yeah, it was a big stretch. and so there was definitely a concern that, you know, I had tried like putting the word out on my blog and that didn't really get any response. And then I had a couple of friends who are newspaper reporters who were kind enough to take a press release that I had done and then little interviews with me based on that. And that generated, I think, maybe two or three of my first interviews. And then I felt like, okay, maybe this will actually work.
Yeah. And I think the other issue you really had was that, didn't you have an idea that you were going to kind of look at this from a historical perspective? Mm-hmm. And then another book came out that did exactly that. So basically just torpedoed your idea from the get-go.
Yeah, it was a real punch, but I decided that it was just indicated that I just needed to shift gears and tackle the bits that I hadn't really tried to tackle yet. So I guess I'm always up for a challenge.
Well, I suppose looking back, it was quite fortuitous because at the end of the day, we've now got a book which has probably a collection of encounters that may never have seen the light of day, Michelle.
Yeah, I actually feel very lucky that drastic change was forced upon me. I'm totally happy with how it turned out. And I think, you know, the eyewitnesses that worked with me on the book, I think they're happy too. So it's a win-win situation at this point.
Yeah. I bet it didn't feel like that at the time though.
Nope.
Right. Rip all that up. Right. Right. Let's start again.
It was devastating.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously I've heard you speak about the germination of the book because I think you said obviously Strange Maine came out in 2010, around there. And obviously this book was near enough sort of given the green light just after you'd finished that. So I suppose some people go, well, 11 years to write a book. but as you say there, it must be heartbreaking to basically plan something out. And I know obviously you had some issues because you and Lauren were going to do it originally. And then obviously Lauren unfortunately had some health issues and backed out. So then you were driving the car, as it were. Yeah. Then you discover that what you wanted to produce was already out there. So I'm damn impressed you got it out. However, because so many times you would have felt like, oh, this book's just destined not to be released.
Yeah. And I mean, when I was doing all the final steps on it and submitting the final drafts and everything to the publisher last year in the middle of COVID, I was like, and everything was getting delayed at that point too. I was like, oh, okay, so it's taken me this long to get it out. And now that it's finally done, everything's going to get pushed back again. So, you know, but I'm nothing if not persistent. So, and now it's real and it's in people's hands and it's generating a lot of curiosity, which is great.
Yeah.
That's my whole goal.
Well, good. And you should be very proud of it. It's a fantastic book. And I mean that most sincerely. And one of the aspects I really love, I love your illustrations. There are some wonderful little drawings that you put in the book for certain stories. My favourite one is the little lad hanging off the clothesline with the pegs, you know, when he has his encounter in that back garden. And there's lots of lovely little drawings like that throughout the book, which gives it a bit more of a sort of real grounding in the state. Because, you know, as we touch on, Maine is not one of those areas that people would be very forthcoming in thinking. If you think about Bigfoot hotspots, you know, people will always point as usual, and I'm sure you're sick of having to answer about the Pacific Northwest, California, Florida. Obviously you've got things like Boggy Creek in the southern states and things like that. But this corner of the United States and Canada is quite unique in my experience from what I've read and people I've spoken to, that there doesn't seem to be that much that people outside of the immediate areas, because a lot of people point to sort of Quebec and New Brunswick in Canada as being very quiet for Canadian Bigfoot reports, which is unusual because a lot of people would primarily think that Canada would be a really big hotspot. But once again, tends to be on the West Coast over there as well.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's simply because people aren't reporting, because it's become clear that people not reporting is a pretty common thing,
mm-hmm.
or if it's because of where the attention is,
mm-hmm.
the long history on the Pacific Northwest coast, which, you know, is very well documented. Yeah. So you wonder if it's that, or if it is actually a low grade of activity, but I suspect it might be mostly people not reporting. And also low population density, so maybe slightly lower encounters simply because of that. There's less crossing of paths when there's less paths to cross.
Yeah. And I think one of those aspects of Maine is that a lot of people, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, I'm one of those people that's got a weird knowledge of the United States. Knowing the capital city of Maine once won me a pub quiz over here, which I was very pleased with, along with which state in America is the only one that's got the Union Jack on, which is Hawaii, is one of those pub quizzes that they throw things at us about Maine that most people, other than perhaps Stephen King or Patrick Dempsey, most people don't know much about Maine. But I've known a lot about it being quite a weird state. A lot of it to do with your blog, Michelle. But also the fact that one of my favourite sea monsters was hanging around off the coast of that, which was Cassie, I think it was.
Yeah, Cassie. Yeah, that's great. Oh, wow. I did not hear many people reference Cassie from outside of Maine or even in Maine.
Well, after Bigfoot, one of my next cryptozoological love is sea and lake monsters. Obviously, living in Britain, we're spot for choice with one of the main superstars of water-based cryptids with Nessie. So anything like that, I've always got a big thing. And you're not too far away from, you know, Champ's hunting ground as well. So and obviously Canada is full of them.
Yeah.
with wonderfully original names. So it's a state that I've always found has attracted the weird. And, you know, as we touched on, and as I've heard, we also have a deep respect for your most famous author, Stephen King. And I think we both have it, the similar favourite book, because my favourite Stephen King book is Salem's Lot. And I know that's a book that terrified you as a teenager for the best part of 20 years, wasn't it?
Yes. Still something that is I find best to read as the sun is coming up as opposed to when the sun is going down. Yeah, it still has an effect on me. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of two books I read as a teenager like you that it's one of the few books I've had to put down and read and reread later.
Yep.
I gave it a week. It didn't frighten me that much. Along with The Rats and It, the first time I read It, they're the only other books that I've had to stop reading for a couple of days just to kind of get my head around what I'm reading.
Yep. Yeah. Take a breather.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So when you decided to sort of change direction and tact on the book, Michelle, I suppose the most daunting thing is, how on earth do I find a Bigfoot witness? So what was your plan in regards to, I know you obviously referred to that you'd kind of put a couple of press releases out that friends had very kindly put forward. So did someone come to you and kind of say, I think this lady's being straight up? Because I would imagine, as we've touched on, a lot of people are very reticent about coming forward, especially when we're talking about things that aren't officially or things that officially don't exist. And we all are very aware of the ridicule that people get, regardless of any kind of strange creature, that people are just laughed at. Not so much these days, as you refer to, people seem to be able to find a more sympathetic and reliable ear when they come forward, Michelle. So for you, I suppose that was probably the most daunting thing, because it's probably really difficult to kind of think, well, how do I talk to somebody about this?
Yeah, it's I'm fairly methodical when I approach things. So, you know, I put out the press releases. I made up a little questionnaire for myself so that I would have it in front of me when I was talking to people, so that, you know, because in the heat of conversation, you can easily forget important things that you wanted to ask. And so it kind of gave me a little checklist to work through. I discovered that the best way to do it was to simply let the person tell their story through first. Once we, you know, introduced ourselves and kind of gotten a feel for each other, over the phone or in person. And then, afterwards, kind of backtracking with my little checklist of questions, you know, asking certain things that might have been left out in the original, and, you know, either they'd remember or they didn't. People were generally really good about, you know, if they didn't remember something, they didn't just make something up. They said, you know what, I honestly don't remember. so that was good. I think it was very lucky to have spoken to a bunch of very earnest people who, you know, had nothing to gain from telling me this other than, you know, helping me put it down on record and maybe helping other people who had had similar experiences to know that they weren't alone and they're not crazy. There are things out there that we can't explain yet.
Yeah. Who was the first person that you spoke to that features in the book? Who was that first witness?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to think back. It might have been John Hawkins.
Mm-hmm.
Who had the encounter in the White Mountains on the New Hampshire border. I think he might have been the very first one.
Yeah.
And then not far after him were, Mike Ledbury.
Yeah.
Ties into the Durham Gorilla story.
Yes.
The Dunphys on their fishing trip. And then the really bonkers one in Northport with the very mysterious accident.
Yes.
Yeah. So those, it was right off the bat, like John Hawkins' story was very interesting to me, and he definitely conveyed the terror that he felt in those yes. moments.
Yes.
So that was a good start. But then when I got into the encounters where people had actually really seen things, that I think that changed a lot of stuff for me. It made me really start to consider, you know, what was going on? Yes. What are these people seeing? Because they're not, like, it was very clear. This is not a bear. It's not a moose. It's not somebody dressed in a ghillie suit. You know, it's none of these things. It's something else. And yeah, after the first few eyewitness interviews, I really began looking at it and trying to really concentrate on what could it possibly be, and how could it possibly be here with leaving very little trace.
Yeah.
Beyond these encounters. Hmm. So.
The other aspect of it is there's a wide variety of experiences in your book. You know, as you mentioned, the creepy footprints, they are always the kind of story that give me the chills when I hear people that have gone out camping around North America and they're laid in a tent in this beautiful idyllic woodland. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, they can hear something walking around them and they know it's something walking. It's not, a curious wolf or a bear or a moose or anything like that. It's something on 2 feet, and occasionally it might try and touch the tent and oh no, thank you. But as you referred to there in regards to some of the witnesses, the Dunham Gorilla flap of 1973 is one of those interesting aspects of Bigfoot, because there seems to have been a real series of these across the country in the early 70s. And I know a lot of people say, oh well, perhaps people were getting overexcited because of Patson Gimlin or the release of The Beast of Boggy Creek. But
yeah.
I find it very odd. It's one of those things that people say, oh, well, everybody's seen these kind of things, like when they kind of point out about UFO sightings in the 50s spiking, because apparently that's all people did was go to the cinema and watch UFO films, which I find very hard to believe. And looking at some of the box office results for a lot of these films, Michelle, that's clearly not true.
Yeah.
So this is one of those stories where I think when you looked at it, it probably didn't seem particularly overly interesting. And yet, as soon as you started to dig into it, a lot of problems started to arise about how the witnesses were treated. I think even people's names had been misprinted in the papers and they weren't even their right names and things. So can you tell us a bit about this very intriguing case that was far more than meets the eye?
Sure. It took place in July of 1973. And it was a summer day. There was a small group of kids. Tamara was, I think, 13. And her friend that she was with was slightly older than her, I think 14. And Lois, that was her friend. And they had been biking around because it was summer vacation and that's what you did. Lois's two younger brothers were with her, and they were on smaller bikes and not moving quite so quickly. So Lois had to stick behind with them, and Tamara had managed to get way ahead of them. I think probably I figured it out. It was about a quarter mile ahead of them on this road. Hmm. So we could hear them around the bend, but she could not see them anymore. And so she stopped. She found a good stopping point at the crest of this little hill in the road, and stopped her bike and was hanging out and looking around like you do. And she looked into the woods off to her right, and there was something looking back at her. And it was about her height, covered in dark fur, with almost like luminous, like lime green eyes that really shone in the woods. And they just stared at each other. And she felt like the creature was as curious and surprised as she was. Mm-hmm. And they just looked at each other and wondered. and after this went on for a brief time, the rest of the gang caught up. And Tamara had totally forgotten that they were even back there and that they were approaching. And Lois saw what she was looking at and shrieked. She screamed, fell off of her bike, and Everything was mayhem. The creature sort of pivoted around and walked off into the woods and said, okay, it's time to go. And everything else was just, from then on, just erupted in mayhem. They headed back to Lois's parents' house to get her knee fixed up because she had skinned her knee when she toppled off her bike. And then, of course, in the process of that, the story came out about how it had happened. And law enforcement was called. The press found out about it. And then for, I think, probably the next week or so, things were just bonkers.
Mm.
And Tara is still annoyed about what happened with it, and rightfully so, because it sounds like it was completely over the top. I mean, it literally was like something out of one of those Monster Hunt movies that you see that's so stereotypical on TV.
Mm.
But because, you know, a radio station was on the air that evening saying, there's a, you know, a giant wild creature loose in town and everybody look out. I mean, that just sort of fomented, you know, it's, I mean, I guess it's the Twitter of the day, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Everybody responds to that. And the next day you have people cruising up and down that stretch of road with guns, you know, trying to go into the woods to look for things. And, you know, dozens of law enforcement officers involved in scanning the area. And yeah, it turned into a big mess. And
yes, and we get one of those alleged solutions that obviously there are so many interesting aspects to this, because as we often find in these cases, Michelle, it's somebody in a gorilla suit. We're not bothered what you think because you're a child and therefore your opinion's invalid. It seems to be the case whenever we have a Bigfoot encounter that involves teenagers, children, whatever. They're usually overactive imaginations, which is odd because there doesn't seem to be much of that happening over here in Europe, which is unusual. And obviously Tamara is basically mothballed in the fact that it's either an escaped monkey from a local wildlife park, or there was a couple of weird establishments in the area or something that kind of gets blamed for it. And then obviously it's a prankster in a monkey suit, and then that's it. Let's not talk about it anymore. It's done.
Yeah. And there are still people who claim that they had family members or friends who were the ones who were in the monkey suits.
Mm.
But I have not yet been successful in talking to any of them, because at that point, I have no doubt that there were people who were willing to get in on it and start wandering around in a monkey suit, you know, like that. You know, that would not surprise me at all. I mean, you know, we do love a good joke person. So, but yeah, the fact that, you know, on researching it, I discovered that, yes, there were multiple wild animal parks in proximity to it, which just is fascinating to me, but still does not match the description of what was seen. So, so not only do you have this mystery hominid, but you also have a large local population of exotic animals as well. So, and people with gorilla suits. So it's just a big, I guess I'll go with tomorrow's Seven Ring Circus.
Yes.
Because that pretty much seems to fit.
Yeah. And there's a couple of interesting aspects of this. Tamara, I think when she's speaking with you in your book, it really does seem to have had a profound effect on her life, because she was obviously very upset, because she seemed to sort of connect with whatever she'd encountered. She says the way they were looking at each other, and as almost as if they were as inquisitive about each other as you could be, as though neither of them had ever seen what they were looking at before, and therefore it was a bit like looking into a mirror of reality for both of them, Michelle. And she was very upset about the way that these monster hunters turned up, because in her opinion it was a juvenile, and she was more concerned about these people trying to hunt this poor young thing down. And where was its family? Why was it there? It's going to be out there on its own. It's scared. And that is a really interesting emotional response that you don't often get in any kind of encounter such as this, especially ones involving children, Michelle, were you surprised that even, what, nearly 50 years on, Tamara is clearly still very emotionally attached to that period of her life?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's such a remarkable incident and such devastating consequences at the time that, you know, it continues to echo to this day. I think that for a lot of the eyewitnesses I spoke to, if they had gone public with what they had seen, and when they did, some of them did, it had a similar effect where this changed their life in more than just a conceptual way, where they're like, I saw something that shouldn't exist.
Yeah.
Like that's enough on its own. You know, that's huge, huge worldview changing experience. And then you have like the societal eruption that happens when it becomes public. And that just adds, it not only complicates things, but it also kind of decimates any chance you might have had to establish some sort of contact, if that's what you were interested in doing. Like, I feel like Mike Ledbury's case, which was a few years after that, he had ample opportunity to engage however he wanted to with the creatures that lived in his area, and which is, I think, less than 2 miles from where Tamara's encounter occurred. He had the luxury, you know, of really exploring that experience where she had to just kind of walk away from it because of what happened in the following days. So I can imagine that that would have, I can only imagine that would have a huge impact on your entire life after that point.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well, because none of the other witnesses are happy, want to talk about it. As far as they're concerned, it's somebody in a gorilla suit. That's it. It's done. They're not interested. And it's one of those aspects is it the fact that they don't want to talk about it because they know that that's not true? Or is it that aspect of they saw this seven ring circus that occurred after it? They were probably called every name under the sun, you know, pointed out in the street, going, oh, look, there's those people who saw that, who saw Bigfoot. We know that goes on. But it's very interesting that they won't even say, oh, well, it was just this. They just don't want to talk about it at all, do they?
Yeah, they don't. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate that Neota, Lois's mom, who, according to the newspaper reports, also had encounters of her own, it's unfortunate that she passed away before I had a chance to interview her, like many years before. Because I feel like reading her, the reporters that spoke to her, she was very interested in the animal as a creature as well, you know, wanting to leave bananas out for it, wanting to make sure it was safe.
Yeah.
And in, I think some of her, the writing that appeared after she died, some of the obituaries, it talked a lot about how she was a very adventurous person. She spent a lot of time outdoors adventuring and, you know, was really just a wonderful person. And, you know, I wish I could have met her because I wonder what she would have said too. But we'll never know. And yeah, and the rest of the family is just the surviving family members are just not, it's not, it's had too much negative impact on them for them to even want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. No, it's unfortunate, but I mean, fair play to Tamara. She's, you know, she's not hiding anywhere. She's very adamant about what happened, and she seems proud to be able to say that she's had such an encounter. It seems to have enriched her life.
Yeah. She's as I think I mentioned in the book, you know, she's a data-oriented person, and this has always been a big blank spot for her. And like me, she's very curious, and you know, her assumption, like mine, is that we don't know everything yet.
Yeah.
And that's kind of wonderful. You know, there's so much room for exploration left when you don't know everything yet. You can continue asking questions, you know, poking your head around corners, lifting up, you know, hopefully nothing bites you, but you know,
yes.
You know, it's nice to know there's stuff out there that we haven't pinned to a specimen tray yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, talking about things out there, I think the next case I want to touch on is probably one we don't want to try and have an encounter with, which is Janelle Graff's and her family's encounter, primarily because this starts off like a horror film, because I don't understand. This is one of those aspects about the Bigfoot phenomenon, Michelle, when occasions like this occur, where a family stumble across something attacking one of their domesticated animals. In this case, I think it's a pig in a barn.
Yeah.
And the poor animal is mutilated, from what I can remember. I find that's one of the most interesting aspects of this, because that's basically the starting point for this series of incidents that happens to Janelle and her family over the next few days and weeks. Nobody seems to be willing to kind of explain what's happened to this pig at all. It's almost as if that's not happened and they're just going to talk about everything else. And often when you have situations like this, where something like this has happened, there's the, you know, occasions where people have had shed doors ripped off by something with its bare hands, or something's killed lots of chickens, or on occasions pigs have been stolen out of a pen that, you know, you've got to climb over a fence to get in there because nobody's got in. But where's the pigs gone? And yet this just sounds like a horrific start that, you know, when at this period and where this family lived, you would be terrified about what on earth was going on, especially when you started seeing what it was.
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, in relating her story, I didn't think too deeply about that because there's so much which is part of her story. So it was just one of many things. But that's something I think one of my other interviewers asked me about that too. And it definitely begs some inquiry, like, because I think normally when we've heard stories elsewhere in the U.S. about Bigfoot type creatures having aggressive encounters with domesticated animals, it's usually been a territorial kind of thing. Like the dogs, I think we've heard a lot of stories about dogs who have had bad run-ins, potentially with Bigfoot. But this is something different. So I don't know, you know, so my imagination gets going and I start wondering, like, what are the possible reasons for that first encounter? You know, did the creature try to take shelter in the barn and discover there was an irate pig that it had to teach a lesson to? Did it originally go in there because it was looking for food and then discovered that was more than it really wanted to deal with, especially once the humans came along, the alarm had been raised? There's definitely some unanswered questions in association with that. And, you know, I know in some schools of people who are, you know, who pay attention to the Bigfoot phenomena, there are a lot of people who really focus on the aggressive encounters, the violence, the potential for maiming and death, you know.
Yes.
And that's generally not, like, most of the people I talked to, there was very little of that. It was mostly just the projection of that threat that was enough to dissuade people from, you know, approaching any closer. But this is definitely one. And I wonder if it's because, you know, if you're a family living on a farm, working the woods, like, there's nowhere else you're going to go.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of have to deal with stuff like this and take it in strides and hope it goes away and leaves you alone, you know. And I think that's most of what they wound up doing, especially once they had the encounter in the woods when he was out with the skidder.
Yes.
And good chase, you know, he still went back out to work again, you know, because there's nothing else you can do. Like, that's your livelihood. And so I wonder if that kind of just accepting that event as part of that chain of events is partly because of that, where you're just like, it happened. Move along, you know, like, get on with the life. Like, because that it would fit.
Well, it is the realization that nobody else is going to do what needs doing, are they? You've got to get on with it, I suppose. And it's one of those aspects of these kind of cases that we don't really comprehend sometimes, Michelle, that these are just people. This is their livelihood. This is their the way they make a living. This is how they survive. And yet, I suppose if you've got a hairy creature running about where you are, you basically, well, if I don't go out there, we're not going to have any dinner on the table. There's going to be nothing to eat. There'll be no fire, no wood on the fire. So you know, I'm just going to sit in my cab and hope for the best.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
You can't just call up Uber Eats or something. Like,
you know? Yeah.
That did not exist then. And, you know, it's, you know, people who, and a lot of people in Maine just live daily lives where they don't have, you know, ample economic opportunities. Like, Maine is known for being hard scrabble, for being able to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and to get the job done. And there's a reason for that. Because I mean, a huge part of Maine is technically still frontier.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a remarkable one as well. Because once again, it's one of these stories where the father in this is one of those people that's very matter of fact. He has a great reputation as a trustworthy and honest man.
Mm-hmm.
And even so, he finds himself being pillared in the community because of what he's basically just said. Well, this is what's going on, and the law enforcement and the wardens are like, we know he's a trustworthy guy, but he can't possibly be seeing this. But then once again, we've got a guy that spends his entire working life outside. He knows what a bear looks like. He knows what's going on. It's one of those that when we think about all these people that are in this area, Michelle, they must have been seeing what went on, you know, like we're talking about Tamara and what's gone on with Janelle and her dad and the family. Anybody else that's having these experiences must look at what went on in these cases and thought, there's no way I'm telling anybody about this, especially in this one, because that's another one where once again, they're basically saying, well, he's telling us this and we know he's okay, but it can't be true.
Yeah, it can't, like, you know, even now, decades later, talking to the game warden, who was one of the ones that, responded initially to the reports, like, he's like, you know, he saw something that scared him, and he's not a scaredy cat guy.
Mm.
But, you know, he can't, like, the game warden was like, you know, maybe it was, you know, somebody pranking him dressed up in a costume, you know, and it's just like, who, you know, would somebody really actually do that in, you know, areas of Maine where people are known to carry firearms because they might run into bears during work?
You know,
like, and so, yeah. So, but, you know, even somebody who completely believed him still wants to find like a plan B, but maybe it was this other thing.
Hmm.
And it's just built in. It's like, there's a wall that won't let them make that leap between what they understand the person saw and what it really could be. There's a barrier there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I suppose for the family, the best thing about it is that because he was so upfront about this and said, yeah, this has happened and there's nothing you can say that's going to change my mind. Other people thought, well, we're going to speak with him because we've had this experience and now we know here's somebody that just doesn't give a damn what authorities are telling him. We're going to share it. So clearly, there was something going on that officialdom just didn't want to kind of say, oh, there's something weird going on here. As far as they were concerned, like you say, yeah, that always makes me laugh. It's somebody pranking. It's this guy in this gorilla suit again, Michelle. I mean, you know, in an area like that, they're not going to be, you know, if you see a Bigfoot wearing a red cap in a wood, you know, it's a prankster.
But like you said, there were beneficial results. I mean, Janelle to this day is continuing that work. I think with even more gusto now that she has the time to spend on it. And she's working with Michael Vachon doing the Maine Bigfoot Foundation.
Mm.
And they're pretty easy to find on Facebook and online. And they're exploring current reports from people. So, that is basically their goal, is to be there for people to report to and not be made fun of, and have people who are genuinely interested band together and go check things out when people are worried or curious.
I suppose it justifies her father's legacy as well, because if, you know, they're being maligned and ostracized by being honest, that would give you a real determination to say, I don't give a damn. I want to prove you wrong, and this happened to us. We know what we saw, because, you know, obviously Janelle saw it. They had numerous incidents. There were footprints cast. There were all kinds of things going on other neighbors saw it. It wasn't just a, you know, a fleeting glimpse of something running in the woods. These were real class A encounters they had.
Yep, with multiple creatures involved. So, and they're still going on today.
Mm.
That area is still incredibly active.
It's a good place not to have a farm. I think that's what we're saying. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, there's a lot of these encounters where you're trying to sell me a dud here, Michelle, because you keep telling me that there's no fear factor going on here. And I think other than Tamara's, everything seems a bit frightening for me. But anyway, the next one I loved is the Dumfies, father and son, fishermen.
Yeah.
Having a lovely day, having a great day's fishing. And then their lives change about this to the point that I think, what is it, 25, 30 years on, they still 100% are adamant. They know exactly what they saw. They know exactly what went on. There's nothing you can say to those two guys that's going to change their mind. They know they saw wasn't a bear. It wasn't a moose. It wasn't a porcupine standing on its hind legs, whatever. They saw some unknown creature just appear and ruin their fishing.
Definitely ruin their fishing. Yeah, and the thing is, it's interesting because when it happened, they basically, you know, with eye contact for the most part, established that they had both seen the same thing. They left. They didn't talk about it at all for years and years and years. And it wasn't until later when they started running across more reports of it that, you know, they started talking to each other about it again, and they're both still in complete agreement. That was not anything that's on the main large mammal species list. It's something completely other. And they both knew it the instant they saw it. It was clear as day. So yeah, they have no question about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the aspects of certain encounters, Michelle, I always find interesting, is that especially when you've got two witnesses and they both see the same thing and they both know they've seen the same thing, and then they just don't talk about it for years.
Yeah.
It's almost as if they're scared of having that conversation because it makes it real.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. It's a worldview changing event. And, you know, not everybody's ready for that.
Clearly.
Some people go into the woods in search of that, but you know, when you're just out for a fishing trip, that's probably not what you had on your mind for the agenda that day.
Yeah, very true. And I think the other aspect of this is often with these kind of encounters, it's very easy, as you mentioned right at the beginning of this conversation, Michelle, for some people to exaggerate or add to it. And the father has continued going back to the same spot. He's taken other people there.
Yeah.
Not seen anything. Which, for me, once again, gives these kind of experiences validation, because a lot of them are just one-offs. They're not a regular series of events. I mean, obviously, you've got a couple of witness encounters with multiple interactions in a variety of situations. But for the most part, these are one-off encounters that change these people's very lives. And this is one of those, because it has changed it. It's probably changed the father and son dynamic, because they both experienced something ground shaking. Clearly the dad is desperate for that validation, Michelle, I think, to see it again, just to prove, I think, to himself more than anything, that it's definitely what he thinks it is.
I think he's, you know, in speaking to him, and I actually got to, I met him earlier this summer, in my shop, and you know, I just think he's still frustrated that he didn't that very day go and check for prints. I think he's just so annoyed that he missed that opportunity.
Yeah.
But you know, there's not much you can do about that except for, well, you know, try again. And that's what he does. So he checks diligently, I think, every time he goes up there now, and you know, it's part of the routine now.
But I suppose it's one of those things. I mean, you know, there's another witness encounter where he says, when he's told his friends, they've all said to him, well, I do this and I do that. And I think even in normal situations in life, if we see a car crash, or we see somebody fall off a bicycle, or something out of the ordinary happens in a normal sense, people freeze. People just don't react, Michelle. So when you see something so cataclysmically out of the box, I'm never surprised when people say, well, I didn't take a picture. I didn't know what to do. We didn't talk about it. We just went home, because essentially these people are in shock.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's no other way to describe it. I mean, I've talked to other eyewitnesses I've talked to another eyewitness just a few weeks ago, and he was describing, he's had, I think, 4 encounters over the course of his life, and all in different locations in the same region, but different locations. And the last one, or next to last one, was with a very different type of behavior in the creature, and much more terrifying. And he was telling me that there were parts of the trip back as they retreated away very quickly from this creature, that he just doesn't remember parts of the return trip. Like, they're just blanks now. Like, it's like his brain shut down and was just like, we're just moving. We're not thinking about anything else. We'll bring you to when you hit where you need to be, and that's it. And I feel like the brain has self-defense mechanisms that kick in on occasions like that.
Yeah, well, it's probably a protection mechanism, I would imagine. And that happens in all walks of life, I think. Whenever you go through essentially a traumatic experience, Michelle, your brain will try and protect you, because if not, you're going to be in a bit of a mess.
Yeah, big mess.
Very true. And that's not the kind of thing you want to be stuck in the woods with.
No. No, I can't say that. Not a good thing.
I think one of the other stories I loved, primarily because it's one of those that's, as we say, it's not overly threatening, but it shows a level of intelligence, a bit of territorial behaviour. And I suppose you could say it's a bit creepy. And that's Jeff Kane, I think, who once again, we've got another chap having a lovely day's fishing in his favourite spot. And then strange things start occurring, and it takes a while for him to click what's going on, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it wasn't really even until he was beating his hasty retreat back home in his truck that he really put it together. Yeah, he had been out on his, I had to explain this for somebody else. There's a contraption that fishermen use, which has like waders and then a float, kind of like an inner tube where you can kind of put your pieces of your gear or your lunch if you have it with you. And, you know, go out in the water and fish.
Yeah.
And he was in one of those, having a great day. And, started hearing strange noises that shouldn't have been there, because he's in an extremely remote area in Aroostook County with absolutely nothing around it. No people, no homes, nothing, just woods. So he started hearing these sounds over the course of the afternoon as he's fishing away, and the sounds get more definite and louder, various things like, you know, cracking of branches, not just like something pushing through and breaking underbrush, but something snapping a large branch very quickly. And then at the very end, a really terrifying roar, which is what sent him running, splashing through the boggy areas out of the pond in his fishing gear back to his truck, which he admitted was probably not the smartest idea, because it sounded like the roar had come from somewhere near where his truck was parked. But he did not care at that point. He was just going to get to that truck and get out of there. And it wasn't until, you know, he was on the road back home, which was quite a drive, that his brain was like replaying through all of that and realized that the sounds had been circling him. So whatever it was, whatever large thing was paying attention to him as he was just trying to have a nice fishing day, it had been circling all around him. And, you know, that's generally the kind of attention you don't want from something that's bigger than you.
But I often find those kind of encounters a little, like I say, a little creepy. But it also impresses me that when we're dealing with something that doesn't behave like a wild animal. Because, yes, bears and cougars and things can often sneak up on you or basically see you and then come around and then the next thing they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And as if they've appeared by magic, which is often one of those things that, you know, one of those abilities that wild animals seem to have. They just seem to appear from nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Silently, like some kind of woodland ninja, often. And yet this seems to show something that clearly it could see him, it mm-hmm. knew he was there, and mm-hmm. just sort of made some kind of tactical moving around him just to get its bearings and sort of suss him out more than anything.
And also to let him know that it was there.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the other thing, is they're not, in these instances, they're not afraid of you.
Mm.
They're intentionally letting you know that they're there and where they are. Mm. And that implies that they think you should probably move on, you know, go elsewhere. And that, you know, and as, you know, humans being used to being the alpha predators in the hunting world, that doesn't sit well. with hunters and sportsmen, it's a very uncomfortable feeling to find that you're the one that is a target.
Yeah.
And you can tell because you've targeted other creatures yourself. And so you know what that means. So.
And I think in Jeff's case, it had clearly given him three warnings and just got fed up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not listening to me, so I'm now going to shout and scare you.
You are not taking the hint.
Yeah.
The hint that time, yeah. And he's still never gone back. So
clearly, that was its pond, I would suspect, and he wasn't very happy sharing it with someone, perhaps.
Yeah, and the stories that I collected from him, and then corroborated with other people in the area, imply that he's not the only one who's had experiences like that.
Mm.
In that neck of the woods. So, and it's oftentimes mistaken for human activity until the person realizes that literally there are no other human beings around there. There is no way that it could be another human being. So yeah, it's, and when you realize that you are alone with this other thing,
yeah,
this other big thing that doesn't want you there. Yeah. Not an experience most people want to prolong.
No, very much so. Yeah. So since the book's come out, and obviously you've done a few interviews and been featured in the local press, and it's been extremely supportive, and so it should be, because it's a, as I said, it's a fantastic book. Is it the case that the dam has burst when it comes to Bigfoot in Maine, that by your book coming out and the fact that you've treated these people with the respect and confidence in what they're talking to you about, Michelle, that people have gone, basically, that you're someone they can rely on to treat them with seriousness?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that is, if anything, the impression I've got from people, even people who are just simply interested in Bigfoot, who might not have had encounters of their own, there's a feeling of relief that they can actually talk to somebody, or, you know who their friends are that are also interested now. You know, it opens up a dialogue. And the biggest impression I've had is that of relief, that, you know, this can be talked about. And, you know, now that it's out there, hopefully there will be less ridicule, you know, less dismissal. You know, there are always going to be critics and people who haven't experienced anything themselves, who aren't willing to, you know, to look into that with anything approaching a reasonable viewpoint.
Yes.
But I think a lot of that comes from fear, because, you know, it's not something, there are a lot of people who it's something they don't want to believe exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't even entertain the idea of that. So it's threatening even just by the potential of its existence. So, which is that, I mean, that's something that I don't think that's something I can single-handedly change, but at least I can get people to feel more free in discussing what they've experienced and know that, you know, they're just not going to meet that same wall of ridicule and disparagement that they might have in the past.
Yeah. And I suspect it's probably going to be a lot easier to collate your witness reports for the second book, because I think often when situations like this, Michelle, it's once that first book's out, once people are aware of you and the work you do, they just feel comfortable now because they can read the book. They can see that these stories aren't going to be belittled. They're not going to be exaggerated. I mean, the majority of these stories are interesting in their mundaneness. These are people fishing, driving, walking through the woods. You know, these are not people who are actively seeking a Bigfoot encounter. I mean, there are two or three witness stories, which I don't want to spoil for anybody. Buy the book if you want to find out more. Listeners, I guarantee you'll be intrigued, because there are a couple, I must admit, there are a couple of stories in this that made my eyebrows raise because of what these people were saying. Now, I'm not going to disparage their encounters, but there are two in particular that are absolutely mind-blowing, that if what they say has any basis in reality, it's absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know which two I'm referring to. And therefore, you have to take those stories and those witnesses with the sincerity that they've been honest enough to share these encounters with you, because what they say to you, I would expect, takes a lot of guts for them to come forward and just say, this has happened to me, because you can't really talk to somebody over a coffee about that, really, can you?
That's a real tricky business. And I think in if I'm correct in the ones you're thinking of, in both those cases, there was a certain amount of defensive prickliness up front, because they, I think, were expecting to not be listened to, even though, you know, I'd been obviously asking for accounts and experiences and for people to tell me, like I'd been actively seeking that.
Yeah.
They still, I think they had tried telling other people who had said that's what they wanted and met with stone walls most of the time. So, or laughter. Mm. And so I think when they came to me, neither of them was expecting me to actually listen to them.
Yeah. I mean, because they are class A sightings on a different level, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Michelle, it's a wonderful book. And like I said to you before we started the interview, I'm extremely jealous of the fact that your normal job is just my dream to own a bookshop, especially one such as yours, because I've been lucky enough to see some video footage of the store and everything, and it just looks like heaven for me. I could just get lost in there. So how is Green Hand? How long has that been running now? It's been best part of what, a decade, decade and a half since you opened up?
It's been a dozen years.
Wow.
Yeah, I got the key to the front door in August of 2009, so we're right on the anniversary.
Oh, well, happy anniversary to you and the Green Hand.
Thank you.
Oh, brilliant. I mean, it is a wonderful depository of the fact that it's also a secondhand book and secondhand books. So it just looks amazing, because it's one of those, there's just books everywhere. It's incredible. And I would get lost in that, because that's one of the few things, we've not got many things like that where I live here in Sheffield. We've got a couple of big chains, which are, you know, bookshops are brilliant. I love bookshops. I could wander around, but they never have, especially here in the UK, they never have enough books for the subjects I'm interested in. And I'd be delighted to turn up at your bookshop, because I'd probably disappear down a little pathway somewhere and try and find some wonderfully weird books that I'd never come across before. So is it something that, as your love of the weird and the strange has developed, you've built a larger section of that particular subject in your bookshop, Michelle, or have you always had a lovely little area for the weird?
Well, I've always tried to have a nice little area for the weird. The only trick, though, is that generally people who love their books about the weird don't ever want to give them up. And so it's a challenge to get to, you know, come across secondhand books that are in, you know, the favorite topics of, you know, ghosts and UFOs and cryptozoology and mythology and folklore and the occult and astrology and tarot and dreams and psychics. You know, there is a little area in the shop that is all dedicated to all of that stuff. And I have managed to get it to a point where it has a decent amount of substance now, which is good.
Mm.
Partly because in the early days, Lauren Coleman was kind enough when he culled out a bunch of his UFO books, he sold them to me. So that was a nice little boost, because I can only imagine from the amount that he culled out how much he must still have. His library would put my bookstore to shame. But that definitely helped. And yeah, it's and I've always been a believer in the like attracts like kind of formula. And so I figure, you know, if I can put stuff like that I'm really interested in myself out there, it will attract more. And I think it has. I think it has pretty successfully. So
I don't know how you could bear to part with some of them. I'd be oh, I haven't got that one. I'd be putting it to one side for myself, I think.
Well, I do have a fair amount on my own shelf here at home.
Yeah. I mean, I'm terrible. Whenever I go in any sort of where we are here, it's always good to go in. I always go in charity shops because you never know what you could find. And there's always some weird books. I once went to a little town called Todmorden here in the UK, which had a very famous UFO sighting about 40 years ago, and just went in a charity shop there and found a book about Tasmanian tigers, which you would not expect that to be discovered in Todmorden. But you can never write off what you might discover in these little secondhand shops. So I always make sure wherever I go, I always visit them, because you never know what you might find. So it's wonderful. And I was tidying my library up the other week, and I discovered I'd got about 7 books more than once. So my brother has now been donated some books. I'm sure his wife is delighted that he's got some wonderfully weird books coming into it. So Michelle, thank you so much for joining me. Where can everybody get hold of your fabulous 2 books, and also keep up to date with what's going on at the Green Hand and your work?
Oh, well, we're pretty easy to find. If folks want to buy signed copies of my book, you can do it directly for me at greenhandbookshop.com. And otherwise, you know, if you don't need the extra flourish of the signature, I mean, although it's the same price, I don't charge extra for it. You can find it at Amazon and at Acadia Publishing, which is the publisher for both of my books. So you can buy them online through, I think, even Powell's. And a bunch of other spots are selling my books. So it's available in a wide range of places online, which is wonderful. And then if you want to simply see what I'm up to, I have a personal Instagram account which is at msouliere. So MSOULIERE. And then if you just want the bookshop, it's at Green Hand Books.
Fabulous. Brilliant. And your blog still going, your strange main blog?
It is, although it's been languishing a little bit because of me focusing on working on the book, because it's transcribing audio interviews and all of that takes an awful lot of time. So my focus has mostly been on the actual research work and the writing and the illustrating. So it is not as active as it once was, but I am still posting on it. And it's also a treasure trove of old posts, because when I started it, I wanted it to kind of be a treasure chest of weird main information that people could use for their own research to find, you know, their next jumping off point. So there's plenty on there.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. Like I say, I'm not just I'm blowing smoke up your backside, Michelle. I have read it for quite a while. I was being very intrigued all these years about these mysterious white ermines that people was apparently seeing, and then somebody actually caught one and sent you pictures, and I think there's one to post where you were showing some of the animals in winter. I couldn't tell you how you could spot a porcupine eating, but thanks to some of your posts, I now know what to look for if we ever get any here turning up in the UK. So I recommend everything highly, and like I say, thank you so much for joining me. It's a wonderful book. I wish you all the very best with it, and I can't wait to see the second volume when it eventually arrives.
I'm excited for it too. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful to talk to you, Paul.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.